Beavers are the largest rodent in North America. They also happen to have a sizable impact on our environment. And perhaps you have a story about a beaver. Perhaps they've done some damage to your property. Perhaps you've seen them building dams and waterways. And maybe you'd like to share your story, because this hour is just about the beavers of Wisconsin. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And our guest this hour, here to share the story of the beaver in Wisconsin, is Bob Boucher, founder and president of the Superior Bioconservancy. Bob, welcome to you.
Thank you, Lee.
Also joining us, Clay Fraser. He's a restoration ecologist and founder of Native Range Ecological. Clay, welcome to you.
Thank you, Lee. Happy to be on with you today.
And Bob, I'm going to start with you for a brief history of the beaver in Wisconsin and the struggle it's had here.
Well, beavers were very present on the landscape here in pre-settlement. So the fur trade started here actually in the 1650s. And by 1730, it was rolling pretty good, so much so that the beavers were actually locally extirpated. So the old journals would say that you had to go west and north of the Wisconsin River by 1730.
Wow.
So we started getting settled very heavily, in the 1830s. And at that time, it was kind of what I call ecological amnesia. Most of their works and their dams and their structures. But prior to that, all the streams of Wisconsin were filled with beavers, and there was many of the smaller creeks, these little things that you could just step across, had a series of ponds in them. And so the volume of water that was held within these various watersheds was quite a bit multiplied. And what that did was it reconnected the water really to the water table and the groundwater. Mm-hmm. And as it filters through, beaver ponds work like a combination of a stormwater detention pond. So they mitigate flood levels and they mitigate temperatures, they stabilize things. But they also resend that water back through the ground. It comes back up in groundwater. It comes out fairly pure and cold, around 52 degrees or 11 degrees Celsius. So remember, everybody here, all the Native American tribes that were here before, there was no spigot to go and get a drink of water. They just drank out of the streams because the water was clean. And so with that clean water, also, we had much greater biodiversity. We had a lot more waterfowl, a lot more birds, and the landscape was different. So when that draining happened, and farmers came, they had all these very rich organic soils, which were these beaver middens that were all over the landscape of Wisconsin.
Feel like we can thank a beaver for what we have today as America's dairyland.
For a lot of that good soil, yes.
And Clay, when we look at the ecological impact of the beaver, and perhaps when we find the beaver nearly extinct, what's that comparison look like?
I'm sorry, Lee, you mean like in terms of to current
yeah.
conditions?
Well, because the beaver was nearly extinct at one point, right? And now we are spending money to some degree exterminate some beavers. I want a comparison of what sort of Bob set up there with the way, you know, our streams were set and the soil that it created and the clean water that was drinkable. When we were without beavers or they were nearly extinct, what did it look like?
Sure. So, you know, the estimates are that we had, you know, a couple of hundred million beaver on the landscape, you know, as Bob indicated, prior to settlement. And that was probably 150 or 200 years prior to settlement. By the time that we colonized most of, the eastern United States and moving westward, those numbers were already rapidly declined. And current conditions are estimated to be somewhere between 15 and 20 million beaver that are remaining in North America. So they are back on the rise. Their numbers are increasing in certain areas, predominantly where they're being tolerated. But ultimately, yeah, they're making a comeback in places. And there's really a movement from the conservation standpoint that's not really even just isolated to the North American continent. It's really an international movement. And conservationists, ecologists, biologists are beginning to realize the incredible ecological benefits of beaver on the landscape, both hydrologically, as Bob described, but also maybe equally important from a biodiversity support standpoint, what beavers are doing in the landscape in terms of water quality and floodwater mitigation is significant. But we're also in the midst of a biodiversity crisis globally. And so anything that we can do to allow beaver to remain on the landscape and doing what they're doing as a keystone wildlife species is going to be a great benefit. So we identify there's places where beaver conflicts are going to be more significant, and we can talk more about those, some of those mitigation effects later. But where they're allowed to remain, where they're allowed to flourish and come back, we're seeing significant native plant communities reestablish themselves, as well as just overall biodiversity support for invertebrates all the way up into the higher echelons of the food chain.
Bob, can you make the argument from the other side as to why the state has invested millions, had invested millions in eliminating some beavers and their dams, the reasons for this or the arguments that were made that supported it?
Well, there's a dogma within the Department of Natural Resources that beavers damage cold water streams, which is actually, it goes back to a biologist, a guy named Ed Avery back in the 80s and 90s who believed this. And it was a policy that he personally took out about 400 beaver dams. And his study was done by the DNR, but it was never peer reviewed. And I have read it and met with Ed. And it's really quite a flawed approach. So other states like Colorado, Montana, and California are investing quite a bit of money in having beavers back in the landscape. They're a 180 position from ours. So there's no scientific evidence. It's really anecdotal that they look at it and they think, oh, it's warming the water. It isn't. It actually provides a lot of refugia for especially fry. So beaver ponds, this has come back up. They add complexity. And there's always cold water there, but there's also warmer water in winter. And that allows the fish to continue to grow through the winter because there's biotic process. So if it's 20 below zero, that water in the stream will be right at ground temperature in various pockets. And the fish will congregate in those things and thrive. And so we've been challenging this. Our organization challenged the DNR to do an environmental assessment of this. And it still hasn't been released. Normally, an environmental assessment takes 3 to 6 months. We filed actually a notice that we'll sue you if you don't do this 3 years ago, and they still haven't released the statement. I was also part of the beaver management. So Wisconsin DNR this year, going back 25, it ended in January, is going through, they go through a 10-year review of to have an official document, which is a beaver management document. And in that process, we proposed a number of really strategic things. First of all, with the North American model, you have to know what do you have there for an asset, and like how many beavers. So this is the natural capital that we have, and it's part of the public trust doctrine that you and I, the air, the water, and the wildlife, are, the DNR's job is to act as trustee to ensure that those are, that is healthy for future generations, and also so to be the guardian of that, like the Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act. And beavers provide a structure for that. So Wisconsin is really very much out of step with the rest of the United States and the world, for that matter, in terms of its policy. And we've been challenging that. So we came forward with a new management plan, which would take each watershed, and using your phone, you would have it basically a type of management collector, which looks at each watershed similar to your health care chart, your health card, your health chart. So your doctor or your dermatologist or somebody can put in different things. So each watershed would have a file in it, and it was cloud-based, and so I had a fellow that I worked with design this, and so you would simply press a button, and it would, let's say, where you harvested it, but you could also put in different types of data, like for endangered species. So each watershed, it's a new model, because currently they just divide the state in four ways, and there's a six-month season, four zones. There's a six-month season, and they don't keep track of any harvest data, they don't keep track of any population data, they don't really know what they're doing, because you have to know what the how much of an asset you have, so your capital, your natural capital. So we've been encouraging them and put forward a plan. So they're in the process of writing a plan right now. We'll see if they actually decide to do a pivot, because it's a big pivot for government to say, oh, we've been wasting millions of dollars for years. And, you know, we heard that in Vietnam. We've heard that with many different political situations. But technically, it's supposed to be a scientific organization. So if science can be the rule here and basically the arbitrator, beavers will be appreciated. And also, but people have to understand that they do change the landscape, and it can be dynamic, and it can cause nuisance flooding. And Clay's company, he's part of what's called the Beaver Corps, can work with citizens and towns and lake districts and things like that to put in different types of devices, flow devices, basically non-lethal management. So it's sort of a landscape plumbing tool. So I'd let Clay talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, Clay, from the native range ecological perspective, a little bit about the work you do and what makes your skills so unique.
Sure. Well, you know, ultimately, there's plenty of people in the landscape doing really great work in line with what we're doing from a restoration ecology standpoint. Everyone kind of has a little bit of their own niche on their specialty to put into it. But, you know, we've successfully been able to integrate, you know, beaver coexistence services and beaver mimicry into stream restoration and watershed management in the last few years. I can tell you, you know, it's kind of still very much passion work. It's not incredibly lucrative work to do as a consultant, right? It doesn't account for very much of our business revenue, but it does lead to other things, and it's important work that we're doing. And we identify that, you know, we're really very much in the business of helping educate landowners, land managers, and agency folks, all right, to some of the options that are out there besides lethal management. We identify that lethal management, i.e., you know, that mainly includes trapping, lethal trapping of beaver. It's a tool in the toolbox that land managers have, but traditionally it's been the only tool, or it's been the primary tool that people go to. And I think what we're doing right now is helping educate people, really in the upper Midwest at large, that there are other tools that can be used, oftentimes with greater or more long-term success. So it's been well received. You know, it's slow to come around, as Bob described. I mean, the culture of our DNR is that traditionally beaver have been considered nuisance wildlife species for a long time. And so there's this institutional culture that is slowly changing. There are people inside the department that we're working with in water and in wildlife and fisheries that are open to this, but there are just a lot of institutional barriers to get the work done. And predominantly that means from a regulatory standpoint, when we're putting devices into waterways that are considered public or navigable, as the DNR describes them, we have to go through a pretty arduous permitting process to do this legally and above board. And it's important for us in the community of people doing this type of work to do it legitimately, where we're encouraging people to go through that permitting process, even though right now it's not simple or streamlined or straightforward. It really, you know, we're begging and borrowing on different waterway and wetland permits that exist in Wisconsin already. But it's important because with every project that we're doing, we're essentially just kind of winning hearts and minds of agency staff and helping them become aware and comfortable with these devices.
That's Clay Fraser, a restoration ecologist and founder of Native Range Ecological. Also joining us, Bob Boucher, founder and president of the Superior Bioconservancy. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a story about the beavers, are they a nuisance? Are they an ecological benefit? How do you see it? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll go to Brett and Madison next. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Lee, great show, and glad you got Bob on. He's been a great leader on this for many years. One of the things I wanted to bring up is the role, and I don't know if you touched this, that beaver dams and wetlands can play in flood storage. After the 93 floods that flooded Wisconsin to St. Louis and the whole Midwest, we calculated that restoring about 2% of the watershed, it's Professor Donald Hay and I, that 2% of the watershed could have soaked up that entire flood. It killed 80 people and flooded 20,000 homes and businesses. And, you know, with all the flooding we've seen across Wisconsin with these torrential climate change rains, we need beavers, wetland restoration, and other things as cost-effective flood control. Because it's better to have water in a beaver pond than in somebody's living room. So,
yeah, I thank you for that call, Brett. And Bob, along with mitigating floods, I understand that they have the potential for mitigating droughts. They have the potential for mitigating wildfires as well. And we spend a lot of money on mitigating all these things in other ways.
Right. We did a study. I worked with the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, for a study with the Milwaukee River watershed through the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District. And we did this study in 2000. And with the flood mitigation with beavers, so it was a modeling of if we had, and we, so we modeled it with about 52 dams upstream. And the net result was that it held those, that would basically provide storage for about 1.7 billion gallons of water. Now, the deep tunnel in Milwaukee is about 530. So it's three deep tunnels, and the beavers could build that for free. And MMSD has a green, what they call a green seams program, where they want to buy about 10 to 15,000 acres of this type of wetlands where beavers could do this. Our only obstacle so far has been, we've been requesting getting a, what's called a beaver recovery zone for the Milwaukee River watershed. And we have had sort of silence from the DNR upon that. But the study that Brett just referenced with Dr. Hay did show that we should be doing this really on all our watersheds in Wisconsin. So you can store a lot more water, you get a cleaner water. So the easiest way to get the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, really functioning is to really let beavers restore these headland water streams and restore these wetlands. And we need to have some sort of program that, let's say, rewards farmers or encourages farmers, like through a farm bill or some type of program. But MMSD, the value of that 1.7 billion gallons that they would store, MMSD has a calculator for what that was worth. So it was worth $3.3 billion in flood storage capacity. And we did one short, just so we, in the villages of Bayside and Glendale, we looked at how many houses would we technically take out of the floodplain. It was over 500 homes that we, in essence, would be getting out of. So when you lower peak levels 37%, that's the point where you're often going to an overbank situation. You're getting sewer backups into basements and damaging their rec room or whatever they have downstairs, ruining furnaces. So from a cost-benefit standpoint, you can't beat beavers for the best bang for your buck for something that works 24/7. Doesn't pay. You don't need to pay it overtime. You don't need to pay health care. And just live with nature. And as Clay mentioned, the biodiversity benefits are, so we're in a global biodiversity crisis, and climate is really regulated by the functioning of this, the organism we live on the planet. So beavers rebuild that. So there's such a win-win-win. Steve Wendells, who is a biologist up in Voyageurs National Park, which is up in north Minnesota, where they've, that's a newer national park. So it was started in 1976. So it's about 50 years out now. And in that area there, there's 27 square miles more water because of how beavers, because they were protected, how much water is being stored there. So it's, that ends up being the 10th largest lake in Minnesota. So there's, it changed the landscape significantly. We just need to have an agency that looks upon them as the beneficiaries that they can be for us.
Thank you for the call, Brett. Let's go to Tom in Rhinelander next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for putting on a good show, as always.
Thank you.
My perspective on beaver is a little bit different, maybe. I live in northern Wisconsin, and the northern forest and the northern highland originally had a great deal of mesic forest, older mesic forest, lots of hemlock, lots of maple, and some big pineries. And the way we manage forests now, we have lots and lots of young forest, which promotes larger numbers of beaver. They can simply do better in an aspen forest than they could in an old pinery or an old hemlock forest. And I certainly don't want to see beaver extirpated, but I think that they can have a strong negative impact on another native species, which is brook trout, which are on the skids due to global warming. It's suspected that we're going to lose a lot of our brook trout waters over the years. And in northern Wisconsin, some of the bigger, old, famous brook trout rivers like the Pine and the Peshtigo and the Popple have brook trout that used to get big in those rivers, run into the tributaries and spawn. And the numbers of brook trout have gone way, way down in those rivers due to, in part at least, to beaver dams blocking their ability to make it into the tributaries. And so that's my comment, and yeah. Thank you for taking it.
Oh, I appreciate you calling, Tom, because, Clay, this is part of the argument that the DNR has had with beaver control, at least up until recently.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You know, I mean, this is, as Bob kind of framed it up earlier, this is probably the predominant controversial issue of conflict outside of, you know, infrastructure flooding that we have in our state is this perception that beaver and trout cannot coexist, even though, of course, they have for 10,000 plus years. They co-evolved together. I will say that, you know, there's always going to be isolated stream systems where smaller populations of brook trout may be negatively impacted by beaver. But overall, the reality is, looking at population dynamics from a whole, these species can coexist together just fine. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence on both sides of the and two camps here that indicate that brook trout in some instances are actually encouraged. Their habitat is improved upon. You have larger fish and higher densities of fish in some systems that are beaver influenced, right? So at the end of the day, you know, the caller is right that there are a lot of other factors at play here. I think that beaver are often scapegoated and looked at as, you know, oh, this is the primary reason that they're declining. There's an incredible array of biological reasons that brook trout, like many other species, are in decline right now. And it's not isolated to northern Wisconsin or our state in general. This is a global issue that we're addressing. So, ultimately, there are a lot of places where beaver and trout coexist just fine in our state. There are always going to be instances where there may be short-term negative effects, but we're looking at the larger, greater picture.
Bob, I'd like to get your take on this too, and what you see about how, whether there's a beaver management plan that can protect our cold water trout.
Well, I'm a life member of Trout Unlimited and study the hydrology of the systems. And there's no peer-reviewed, all the peer-reviewed studies, the ones that actually have been scientifically peer-reviewed, show that beaver benefit fisheries in general and cold water streams specifically. They're spending $3 million in California just to protect those estuaries for cold water estuaries for specific salmon. And the studies that was Ed Avery's study that I showed show that all these ponds, these beaver dams are permeable. The fish go through them. They don't. So he took a study where they do a shocking from above the stream. They clip up and they put them below the stream and come back and reshock above it, and the fish come back up through there. So they don't necessarily know how they do it all the time, but they either, you know, they say, you know, they taught them how to jump, but they get through. And also, because the real structure is this cold water, which is necessary, and it's overwinter survival. People are going fishing in spring, summer, a little bit in the fall, but overwinter survival is really key. And having those fry, those longer recruitment of the fisheries. So all the studies point to, in fact, another study done in northern Wisconsin by the DNR, which was actually somewhat suppressed, where the brook trout, brown trout, and rainbow trout all went through the dams. And also the general consensus was that you got greater biomass, the fish got bigger. And so you may have some incidental spot where it appears to be the case, but you have to look at all the whole landscape picture. That if we want a better fishery, the best way to have it is more beaver, frankly. But you also get mussels, because you get this food web, and this goes with it, all those insects for ducks, geese, so many birds, a lot of tree nesting birds are habitat driven or needs, like wood ducks, goldeneye, mergansers. They need that structure that beavers provide. And you'll see that where you have large carnivores, they basically, beavers provide housing, they provide forage food, and they provide really just nesting structure, and it's this engine. These ponds are probably the richest biodiversity we have.
Our guest, that's Bob Boucher, founder and president of the Superior Bioconservancy. Also joining us, Clay Fraser, restoration ecologist and founder of Native Range Ecological. And we're talking about Wisconsin's beavers today at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Tom, thanks again for your call and question. You can also email us, talk@wpr.org. And Bonnie and Mary, we'll get to your calls next in just a couple of minutes. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. We'll be right back. Should we blame the beavers? This hour on the Lee Rayburn Show, we have two wildlife ecologists who want you to believe in our beavers in Wisconsin. And we've had a beaver management plan that has included eliminating beaver dams and eliminating beavers themselves. The state has invested millions in it, and the question is whether or not we're any better off for it. Want to get right back to your questions for our guest, Bob Boucher, founder and president of the Superior Bioconservancy, and Clay Fraser, restoration ecologist and founder of Native Range Ecological. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Mary's next. She's in Plover. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I live on the Wisconsin River. I'm probably not 75 yards from the main channel. And I've never minded beavers until they started taking down all my trees on my bank. I have no idea where they're at. There's just kind of a little outjutting of you know, dirt and trees off to the upriver from me, and maybe they're there, but I've lost about 3 foot in diameter popples. I've lost a whole mess of maples. I'm just waiting for them to crawl up my bank.
and you know, we talked a little bit about biodiversity, and we can't forget about plants here either, but also, you know, beavers are chewing on trees all the time. That's part of what makes their dams. Clay Fraser, for property owners who are looking for beaver management and stories like Mary's, what can we do?
Yeah, this is a really common challenge, you know, when folks are living in beaver country. Nobody wants to come home and find that their prize-winning maple shade tree has been taken out. It's really disheartening. So, you know, fortunately, beavers can't climb trees. And one of the more common and simple solutions that we have is really just to cage up or fence trees. You can do it with individual trees that are larger. You can do it with clusters of trees and shrubs by kind of creating these beaver enclosures. And as long as the fencing is like a, you know, pretty robust chicken wire style fencing, and it's about 4 feet tall, which is the general width of a roll, staking that up around trees is highly effective. It may have to be maintained a little bit, a couple of times a year, but between that or sand painting on trees, beaver don't like to chew on trees that have had sand paint applied to the trunks up to 3 or 4 feet. From a technical standpoint, you can go on to the Beaver Institute website. And there's some technical specifications that outline how to protect trees, again, using sand paint and or fencing.
So if the beavers aren't able to get at Mary's trees, then do they just move upstream? Do they just look for the next spot where the trees aren't protected with fencing or sand painting?
Typically, that's right. You know, if they can't, you know, beaver will travel quite a distance to get to trees, you know, and They're creatures of habit. They're going to go after the low-hanging fruit, literally, if they can. They're going to go after the trees nearest the waterway. But they'll move in inland a little bit and take trees out as well.
Well, you said they can't climb, Clay, so they're only going to go after the low-hanging fruit. That's all they've got.
That's right.
Mary,
that's right.
I thank you for the call, and I hope that helps. And I love the idea of it's as simple as a little bit of fencing, a little chicken wire that goes about 4 feet tall, or some sand painting on the at the base might do some good. So thank you. We'll go to Bonnie in Manitowish Waters next. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I just have a couple funny stories. First of all, my uncle Andy was a beaver trapper, long deceased now. But one time my younger sister was looking out her kitchen window, and dang, this the audacity of a beaver was chewing right on one of her trees. So she runs out there and yells, and that beaver did a flip in the air and then scooted off to the river. And then one time my older sister was feeling under the weather, and her young toddler son comes and says, "Mom, how's your beaver feeling?" And anyway, my sister said, "Honey, I think you meant to say fever." And then the final story is I was living out of Washington, D.C., and that's when a beaver somehow got into the tidal basin and was chewing on the cherry trees, which was an international concern because the trees were from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was getting all sorts of messages from friends and family saying, do we need to send Uncle Andy out there to take care of this problem?
Bonnie, thank you. And I would imagine in Manitowish waters, you would have plenty of beavers. And I am curious, doing the backflip when somebody goes out to shout, how social these beavers are, because obviously they were easier to trap back in the day. And it's although Mary said that she couldn't find them on a riverbank. What's our relationship been like with these beavers between us and them and us humans, Bob?
Well, it's been, you know, for a long time, this country was basically, and Canada was founded on the first economic principle, which the only currency that existed, you know, when settlers got here. So we had this intersection, or call it a collision, between something that's in a Stone Age technology with something that's in a, you know, post-industrial somewhat. So we had metal and things like that. So these tools, so for knives and kettles and cloth and beads and any trade items, axes, muskets, the only currency, the only thing that there was a wallet, the only credit card was fur.
Yep.
And beaver was the dominant fur because it was used in the trade to make hats in Europe. And that trade was basically what really brought and punched in the earliest traders into this country. And that was the thing that fueled the colonization, because they were the first beaver people who came in to take a look at things. And that's why that early transition point happened. But currently, you know, people are not wearing fur because it's not necessarily fashionable or cool. And there's a lot of other lighter stuff that is less expensive. But the social aspect for beavers themselves as a colony, there's a pair that is there. They will have what they refer to, their babies are called kits. They live in a nesting. It's called a colony, that family group. They're monogamous. They will stay together and they will defend a territory. So they have their own little part of the territory. They mark the territory with these scent mounds. And they actually can recognize their own kin from that. So, and the kits, when the kits are 2 years old in the spring, is when they disperse. So, it's kind of like when the parents said, "Okay, you've got a college education, you got to move out, get a job, pay for your own cell phone, pay by your own car." This transition to really growing up, and so at that point, the colonization, and they will disperse at that point. So, but they're also a very intelligent animal, and they recognize when they're under threat. And that's one reason how the whole construction, basically when you look at a beaver lodge inside of a beaver pond, there's a dam there. That's like a little castle, and that's their kingdom. And they'll dig actually ditches or canals to feed to, like what Clay was talking about, where they will go some distance. They will dig these canals, and that connects into floodplains. And that's where the complexity happens, and you get a lot of other species that benefit, like frogs and amphibians. So there's a lot of cascade or trophic cascades. That's why they're known as an ecosystem engineer and a keystone species, because so much happens.
We can all understand a good moat around our castle. I think everybody can appreciate that. Thank you for the call. Let's go to John and Mercer next. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. Here in northern Wisconsin, and there's been a couple calls in Manitowish waters and mm-hmm. such, but much different climate than southern Wisconsin. Our area is known for its high concentration of lakes worldwide, largest, longest chains of lakes, and incidentally with no portages. I'll make another point there. But apparently among bog experts, which stay up here at our resort that we have, they say it's kind of world renowned for the numbers of bogs and great bogs up here too. So in other words, I don't feel a great benefit, especially as a resort owner, that caters to people with disabilities as well as just active lifestyle. A lot of kayaking. We have these long chains of lakes, great canoeing and kayaking, and 8 to 12 dams in a couple of sections of 5 miles long river, 8 to 12 dams, you know, try taking someone with a disability there. I don't care what kind of channel you make for fish passage or whatever else it is, you know, that's off limits. And not really fun for even able-bodied people to have to portage around 8 or 12 dams in a 5-mile stretch.
Well, and tourism is such an important part of that beautiful part of our state, John. It is a great point. And Clay, I would wonder what, you know, Native Range Ecological would say about how do we coexist with this?
Well, number one, you're noticing the pattern, you know, predominantly in our state, the northern tier of Wisconsin is where beaver densities are higher.
Yep.
And there's it's not an accident, right? I mean, there's more water. There's less agriculture. There's probably a lot of areas where, generally speaking, they're more tolerated, right? But it's also really important to understand that all these lakes that exist in the northern tier of our state, which, you know, I partake in that recreation. I fish a lot in northern Wisconsin. We love the pristine lakes. We love to be able to kayak these waters. As humans that recreate on water, we have an innate desire to be able to continually navigate these stream courses. And what we forget is that beaver created these systems more often than not. They created and sustained these wetlands for millennia. If you look at satellite imagery going back as long as we can into the 80s, and then you look at fixed-wing aircraft imagery back into the 1930s, you'll see that all these river and stream systems had beaver dams on them, right? And there's the vestiges, basically the remnants of those dams are still there and creating and sustaining wetlands. So the water quality that we enjoy in the northern tier of the state, we can thank beavers for that very directly. But it's important to remember that, you know, yeah, every once in a while we're going to have to portage or change our routes if beaver come in. And in areas where they're not tolerated to do so, we have to be able to learn to live with them a little bit better.
But as John pointed out, people with disabilities who would want to be able to enjoy these waters, portaging may not be an option for them. Is relocating beavers an option? Is there something that could be done there in an effective way that would be a win-win scenario?
Beaver relocation is done in Wisconsin. It's relatively uncommon. There's actually, you know, there's not a whole lot of regulation around it, provided that the places that you're trapping and relocating the beaver, you have permission to do so on both ends. And with the understanding that if you're creating conflicts with beaver that are relocated, that you may be responsible for those conflicts and you may have to mitigate some of that. But, you know, other places in the country have been doing this for a long, long time, you know, in terms of taking beaver that are in conflict areas and relocating them into areas where they're less likely to get into trouble.
John, thank you so much for the perspective and the call. That's Clay Fraser from the Native Range Ecological. Also joining us, Bob Boucher from the Superior Bioconservancy. And we'll go right back to Lee next in Rhinelander. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I realized the positive aspects of beaver, but up here, we've had some problems. We have some land that we had ski trails on, and the beaver built the dam and flooded the ski trails. More important than that, we had hundreds of old-growth cedar trees that were all drowned and destroyed by the beaver pond that they created. My wife was very upset about this and grabbed her pick and axe and went out to tear up the beaver dam. And did a pretty good job and came back the next day and found that they had rebuilt it. And she kept doing that for a couple of weeks. And she just said that, I'm going to show those beaver I'm more stubborn than they are.
What's the end of the story? Did she win or did the beavers outbattle your wife?
The end of the story is my wife gave up. The beaver won.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And eventually, one of our DNR people up here did come in and dynamite the beaver dam. They certainly are stubborn animals if they can beat my wife in stubbornness.
Well, I think the dynamite would have been the end of that story. But this goes to the nuisance. This goes to the biodiversity. This goes to the loss of old-growth cedar trees, Bob. And so they're... This debate continues, clearly, and we're seeing this from, you know, people who have had firsthand experience and have gone out with pickaxes to get at the beavers.
Well, you've got to understand it's the nature of the land. where those cedars were, if you looked at it, were probably in a historic wetland. And so when the beavers were removed, we drained the land throughout a lot of northern Wisconsin, a meter or 2 meters even in some places. And so if the beavers restore, but those organic soils are there. So if you look at it's really a question of topography and of the landscape. We had some places we did a study down here. We put up a small beaver. It's a 1 meter high hypothetical beaver reach, and it would flood 62 acres. So what beavers do is they create a dynamism in the land, but they also enrich the water. So, you know, we have sewage treatment plants and we have wells and all the stuff, a way to get it. But beavers, in essence, provide that clean water and the biodiversity. For northern Wisconsin, a lot of when people go up for tourism, one of the primary things they want to do is one of the benefits is seeing wildlife. So whether that's a bald eagle, catching fish, seeing an otter, which beaver ponds provide excellent, you know, habitat for, birds, waterfowl, tremendous duck habitat. So if you're going to have when you have a pond, you're going to get all these things with it. And because we took them away and now they're coming back, we probably still only have maybe 5% of what we had in pre-settlement, maybe in some places 10%. But so, and when someone said, well, they had 5 beaver dams in, 5 miles, there's places you can go in rivers like Stevenson Creek over by Trout Lake, and you'll see a beaver dam every 150 yards. So there would be, you'll see, 20 in a mile. But what that has made is a giant wetland complex, and that what comes out of there is very clean water. And yes, if you're going to try to canoe through that, maybe just stay on the lake and go over there to watch the wildlife as opposed to try to force your way up and down it.
Here's what I'm hearing, Clay, is that the things that we love of Wisconsin can largely be attributed back to the beaver population that was here, from our biodiversity to our clean waterways to the soil that we now count on for our farming in Wisconsin. And the things that we love about why we're here now seem to in some way be being infringed upon by the same beavers that helped create it. And we find ourselves with this understanding that perhaps, what they created we want to keep, but the beavers are constantly changing our landscape and we want to maintain what we have right now. And it seems like there could be a balance, but whether or not, that includes spending millions, investing millions on blowing up dams and killing beavers, is that part of the solution? And I know both of you would say no, but what does the solution look like then, since beavers created what we love, but now are challenging the places that where we love them?
Yeah, absolutely, Lee. So, what the caller described is just such a completely common scenario that we see in beaver country, where people get frustrated. They try to manually remove a dam, and or they ask the agencies to come in and do something extreme, like use dynamite, which is just incredibly aggressive and just terrible for waterways in terms of the sedimentation that it creates, and just habitat destruction like that. So the other big element to understand is that these types of activities are incredibly unfruitful. They're not productive. They're temporary measures. And when you're living in beaver country, these animals are going to very quickly come back and rebuild these dams. Sometimes they rebuild them bigger and better than they were before. In fact, we see that very commonly happen. So some of the things that have been done for the last 30 plus years in other parts of the country are these flow devices, right? Where we're putting pipe and intake domes in, pond levelers are one of the more common devices that we use, single intake or dual intake pond levelers. They're incredibly effective when we're using modern iterations of these designs that have evolved over decades by people that have put them in and maintained them well. When they go into the water, they're incredibly effective. Primarily what they're doing is equalizing water levels on either side of a dam and only allowing the water to rise to a certain threshold that is controllable by these devices. These are simple devices that go in the water. They last a decade and they require a couple of hours of annual maintenance and inspection, right? These types of devices can be put in most of the scenarios that we see that have conflicts. Beyond that, the other big one is that beavers plug up culverts, and that's a big problem because we need our roads. We have an incredible network of roads that we rely on in our state, and the culverts drain the ditches and roads and keep those roads navigable. So the culverts have to stay open. And traditionally, road and highway managers have been relegated to going out with equipment numerous times a year. We just heard from somebody up in Ashland County that just already to date, they've been out 23 times with backhoes removing debris and blockage from a single culvert, where one of these culvert protection devices that goes in allows the water to move through these culverts as it needs to from a design standpoint, but prevents the beaver from plugging them up. These devices are simple. They're easy to install and maintain. They're easy to manipulate and remove if need be. But the primary impediment in putting them in is the fact that we need permits to do it from the DNR. Mm-hmm. And these permits don't exist right now. We're borrowing on other permits to do it. So these devices are commonly used in other parts of the country. They're not as common in Wisconsin. They're gaining a foothold, but they are much more sustainable than having to go out, manually remove a dam, blow it up, and or take backhoes into a culvert 20 plus times in a year to clean out blockages.
So there is technology that could help us coexist, but at the same time, there is regulation that makes that very challenging, or lack of regulation that makes that somewhat challenging to persist. Earlier, one of you mentioned the Beaver Institute, and I looked it up at beaverinstitute.org, and I see that there is a BeaverCon coming up at the end of September at the University of Minnesota. Who wants to tell us about BeaverCon?
We both do.
I've got a couple minutes, Bob. I'll let you take it.
It's September 28th. I believe it starts in Minneapolis. There'll be about 400 or 500 people at it. It's where everybody who thinks in the Beaver Believer tribe will descend on it. And there's a lot of exciting work that's being done around the country that is very progressive. And we're hoping that Wisconsin can learn from that. The Beaver Institute, which Clay is part of, he's the only guy in the state who's actually gone through this extensive training. So he's the guy to help you with this. But, you know, one of the sort of the fundamental questions here is, you know, the coexistence idea of approaching this as living with this. And then so let's modify this. Let's put a flow device in, or let's get the device in the culvert. If this beaver is flooding this area here, maybe when the fire comes through and it saves my house because the house didn't burn down, the whole forest didn't burn out, because if it's wet, it won't burn. And do I want to have drinking water? Do I want to have a place to hunt ducks? Do I want to have a place where my kids can go catch frogs? That's what you get with the benefit. Blowing things up with dynamite is counterproductive. But Clay has been on the steering committee for this. So Clay, what do you have to say about BeaverCon?
Yeah, we're incredibly excited to have BeaverCon in the upper Midwest. This is the first time it's been there. This is an international conference that happens every other year. It's usually attended by 500 plus people. It's an incredible mix of scientists from all walks of life, and research, academia, agency level, a lot of land managers, nonprofit organizations that are doing a lot of really active beaver restoration and beaver mimicry work and beaver coexistence advocacy. There's a very big indigenous component woven into this conference. There's our indigenous cultures have understood the benefits of beaver for millennia, right? And so we have a lot to learn from them. So they're really a significant element of this conference. There's an art element to it. There's really something for everybody. We're really, really excited about BeaverCon coming to Minneapolis.
Yeah, who should consider attending, Clay? I mean, is it open to everybody?
Yep. Yes, it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody can register.
And so, it's fun.
Yeah. And for many of the callers today who wanted, who care about the beavers, understand their role in our ecology, but also have, gone at their dams with pickaxes, or their wives had, that anybody who has had a relationship with these beavers or the land that they've helped create, and now, would have an opportunity to learn something at this BeaverCon coming up at the end of September. And again, the Beaver Institute's online. It's easy, beaverinstitute.org, and we'll put a link up on our little section of the website at wpr.org/Lee if you want to check that out at your leisure. And I want to thank you both for this conversation, and I am certain we will be returning to this at some point. So thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you, Lee. This has been fun.
Happy to be here, Lee. Thank you.
Bob Boucher is with the Superior Bioconservancy, and Clay Fraser, founder of Native Range Ecological, and BeaverCon at beaverinstitute.org. I want to thank our team, Joel Patenaude, Clara Nypert, Jeff Robbins, executive producer Jill Nadeau. I want to thank you for the wonderful phone calls and emails today, and apologize that we did not get to them all. Thanks for being a part of the show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. Thank you.